How can business deal with the exponentially increasing rate of change? We must engage our own internal engine of creative destruction and creative reconstruction.
This is the Economics for Business podcast. We're here to help all businesses become champions for customers and value, improving lives with preferred and innovative products and services. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. We are hearing more and more these days about exponential change. It's partly objective. We can, for example, measure the rate of penetration of new technologies in society, observing that the speed is faster and faster for each successive wave of technological innovation. Similarly, we can observe the convergence of technologies, such as sensors, AI, and reconfigurable touchscreens in a smart Internet of Things configuration. It's partly subjective. That speed of penetration is actually a speed of adoption by people. People will use and embrace technology, which depends on their attitudes and their feelings towards technology, their orientation. What does exponential change imply for business? Both the objective, observable elements and the subjective, orientation-based elements. The most important implication is the need for agile adaptiveness. A business can never pause in one place. We can't assume that current conditions are stable or in equilibrium. We must assume the opposite. We must plan for the opposite. We can't assume our organization is the right one. We must be open to new information and new data, and we must process it quickly. Schumpeter's concept of creative destruction, what Silicon Valley and business books call disruption, is only right when incumbents are not adaptive. The correct approach is creative reconstruction, what Austrians call new capital combinations and recombinations. In fact, Austrian economics is the best basis for thinking through exponential change, because Austrians have always seen the market as a place of constant flux and continuous change. Entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial businesses are those that embrace this change, adapt to it, anticipate it, stay ahead of it. And that, as we will learn today, is a matter of orientation, how we orient ourselves to the world of constant change. As always, there's a tool to help us do that, and we'll learn about that tool today. Our guest today is Mark McGrath. Since 2005, Mark has worked in the asset management industry. He's a former Marine Corps officer with a master's degree in economics and an especially deep knowledge of Austrian economics. And he's a devoted student and teacher of the concepts we'll learn about today, VUCA and the OODA loop. Mark, welcome to the Economics for Business podcast.
Thanks, Hunter. Thanks for having me.
You've been engaged in developing, teaching, applying, continuously improving an approach to business that we'll call the adaptive entrepreneurial model. And we're going to delve into the system and all of its elements and components today. We always like at the beginning to give a background, and maybe you can tell everyone quickly about the history and the learning that has brought you to the current state of this model, which is really important, and we're going to go through it in detail. But give us the initial background, Mark.
Sure. Initially, it started about when I was 18 years old, and I was a freshman at Marquette University, where I was going to school in the Naval ROTC program to become a Marine Corps officer. And there was a course that we were required to take called the Evolution of the Art of War. And the design of the course was to introduce future Marine officers to the theories and philosophies of warfighting and some of the big picture perspective that they would need to understand in order to be good officers, but also really to handle chaotic environments, being able to accomplish missions in chaotic environments. And that's where we were introduced to the concepts of things like friction and chaos and uncertainty. And we were exposed to the ideas for the first time, for me anyway, of Sun Tzu, Clausewitz, and of course, John Boyd, who we'll talk a little bit more about later. The primary text that we used is a very small book. It's free online, and it was entitled Warfighting. The official nomenclature at the time was Fleet Marine Force Manual 1. They call it Marine Corps Doctrinal Publication 1. And it's a brief theoretical treatise of the Marine Corps' philosophy on warfighting that every officer and every Marine was expected to read and reread and take the concepts to heart and integrate them into your understanding and into your application of whatever it was that you were doing, planning, operating, learning, et cetera. I've read it probably 20 million times since then. And what's really amazing about it is if you cross out warfighting and you put in business or you put in portfolio management or you put in baseball, you know, you can apply these concepts literally everywhere. And I really learned that after I got out of the Marine Corps. I was in for 6 years active duty. And when I left and got into the business world, initially with a medical startup and then into capital markets and asset management, where I've been for about the last almost 20 years now, I started to realize that the concepts that I learned in the warfighting curriculum, not only in college, but through my time as an officer with the various coursework that we did, was that these principles and ideas were indeed universal, and you could literally use them anywhere. The same kind of mindset that you needed to thrive in chaos in a warfighting or training environment was exactly what you would need in a business or market environment. Very, very similar. And all the change that I saw was the uniform changed and some of the terminology changed, but the principles remained intact. So it really opened my eyes, because when I was in the Marines, we learned how to do it. And then when I stepped out, I was able to see it from a much bigger picture of why and sort of the real power of how these concepts could be not only taught, but learned continuously by myself and teaching them, but showing people how they don't have to have spent one day in the military and they can start to harness these concepts and principles to their own advantage with their own business, whatever it is that they do. So I, that's sort of how I got to the, where I'm at now, where I feel like after all the learning and all the, you know, the books and coursework and everything, I've tried to distill it down to three very easy to remember concepts that address theory and application together, that, hopefully allow people to connect the dots and be able to improve whatever it is that they're doing in business or whatever endeavors. And, you know, eventually it did lead me to the Austrian School of Economics. And that came my last 2 years in the Marines. I was taking graduate courses at night. My first course was macroeconomics, and it didn't make a lot of sense to me. I thought it was very math intensive and a lot of formulas that didn't make any sense. I still don't know what my indifference curves are versus anybody else's. But I think, like a lot of people that have learned Austrian economics, it started with, you know, reading Atlas Shrugged and then reading Milton Friedman, which eventually led me to The Road to Serfdom by Hayek, and then I discovered Mises and Rothbard, and then eventually worked with De Soto and Kirzner, which I think are very applicable to this conversation. But it's been an ongoing journey, such that I stopped that graduate program and I finished somewhere else with exclusively getting a master's in economics, so I could just study the Austrian school thinking, which made more sense to me than anything else. And I guess that's why we're here today, because I've always seen a parallel between the thinking of Mises and Hayek and Huerta de Soto and Kirzner, connected to the strategic theory of John Boyd, which is something that I studied quite extensively. So,
well, let's go there, Mark, and welcome to the Austrian School, by the way.
Thanks.
Let's just put it in value generation context. That's what we're talking about at Economics for Business, how entrepreneurs generate value for other people and for themselves. And in fact, you talk about in your model that it's for all involved. That could be entrepreneurial teams, businesses, their customers, clients, partners, and so on. Just let's give that context of value generation for all involved.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. All involved suggests synergy and harmony, which is at the beginning, I said we started with Sun Tzu, and then we learned Clausewitz, and then we learned Boyd. And I always thought that John Boyd pulled more from he pulled a lot from Eastern philosophy. And if you look at the history of the inputs that went into the OODA loop, which we'll talk about, Eastern philosophy and Eastern thinking was a massive influence on John Boyd. And I think that when we think of all involved, everybody should be better off working together. You know, if I'm working with a firm and we have clients and customers, everybody should be better off for having worked together and having coordinated action together. That's really at the heart of what Boyd was talking about with coordinating action with others, is that we can harmonize our efforts, and you know, ultimately, the better we get at that, the better our results are going to be through time, the better our capacity to learn and make the necessary changes that are required to adapt as circumstances unfold. And I'm paraphrasing Boyd here, but he said something along the lines of that, you know, a sound understanding of these principles, of the theories that he discovered and that he illustrated is where individuals and teams can really achieve geometric results, because they're going to be able to recognize opportunities faster than their competitors or faster than the rate of change within their environment or within markets.
Yep. Yeah, what, as you and I have discussed, is what DeSoto called coordination and higher cooperation, yes, and so on. Well, let's get going through the model, Mark, because it's really fundamental, and we're going to learn three important areas. They all go by initials, and the first one is VUCA, which we've actually come across before, I think, VUCA, but talk us through VUCA.
VUCA is it's a great acronym. It originated from actually the Army War College in an attempt to explain the post-Soviet threat world, I guess the post-Cold War world, where threats were more asymmetric. I guess the thinking became more asymmetric and nonlinear. It wasn't red versus blue or USA versus USSR. Things were very much very, very different. So VUCA was the term, and we could go through each one if that works. We'll go one by one through what it stands for.
Do that.
So VUCA stands for volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. So let's start with volatility. Volatility is really simply, it's just the tendency for things to change quickly and unpredictably. You went to bed one night, and next thing you know, the next day, I don't know, something's dramatically different. It was a beautiful sunny day, and the next day it's a hurricane outside, or it's thunderstorming.
There was an earthquake in Acapulco last night, so those people had some real volatility.
So you think about that. I mean, if you were down there vacationing, that probably wasn't in the travel plans. That probably wasn't expected, right? Again, things change quickly and unpredictably, which leads us right into uncertainty. There's a whole chapter in Human Action titled Uncertainty, but that's the quality or state of being unknown, incomplete, not having certain knowledge, being indefinite or indeterminate. We don't have a crystal ball. We can't see the future clearly. I always love to use the quote from the opening of The Big Short movie, and they attribute it to Mark Twain, but I've also seen it attributed to Will Rogers. It's not the things that you don't know that get you into trouble. It's the things that you're absolutely sure of that turn out not to be true. And that just, to me, that underscores the nature of uncertainty. We're so sure of things, but that's not the way the world works. If I recall from Human Action, I think that the very fact that we act implies uncertainty, because we're not sure what's going to happen and we're not sure what's going to change. So complexity is another favorite, because it's the quality or state of being part of a whole made up of numerous complicated, interconnected, interdependent, or interrelated parts. And I love to use this one a lot, because every time you meet somebody, you know, they say there's less than 6 degrees of separation. For me, somehow it always happens to be maybe two. Three is a lot, right? And, you know, we're all connected in some way. You could go through, I was telling my daughter this on a recent trip out west. We're in an airport in Denver. And I said, we probably walked by three or four people that we know. We just don't know they're, we just didn't know that they're here. Connectivity works in strange ways. And I think that it's been amplified in our own epoch because of technology and social media and the fact that we can get information so rapidly via phones and computers and iPads and that sort of thing. But things are also interconnected. You know, what happens to one might have a ripple effect on many other things. So, you know, what happens to, you know, one industry could have a lasting effect that ripples throughout several others because they're all interconnected in several ways. But, you know, just in general, I find that people are very connected if they make the effort to try to understand, why. And then the last letter is of A, of VUCA, is ambiguity. And that's the quality of being perceived in two or more possible interpretations by multiple observers from multiple perspectives. We can look at the same exact fact and we could come up with completely different conclusions based off of our own understanding of the world, our own perceptions, our own understanding of business, our own understanding of anything. We could look at the same exact thing and have two completely different conclusions of what it is and what needs to be done.
So yeah, you always emphasize, Mark, VUCA is the world. It's the state of the universe, you say, or the market or the business context you're operating in. It's always there. It's never going to change. It's always VUCA, right? We've got to
remember. If you accept it, and that's the first cornerstone of the model, this is really where the theoretical aspect of it comes in. If you can accept that, then you can learn how to thrive in it. I was thumbing through, I think it was Mises' last book that he was working on before he passed, The Ultimate Foundation of Economic Science. And the chapter opens up with a Greek term actually written in Greek, but it's Heraclitus basically saying that everything is in a state of ceaseless flux. There is no permanent being and all is change in becoming. And that's a universal truth. I think that when we accept that, things are always going to be changed. It's always going to be a constant, and we can account for that. And that's what ultimately empowers us to thrive. Because a lot of people will think that they can control it, or they can make it go away, or they can eliminate it. And you can't. You know, use the earthquake example. You know, there's no way I could have planned for that. You know, yeah. That's the state of the universe. Things are going to happen without my without warning, without signal, and I have to be able to adapt quickly to that. It's nothing to fear because it's just the state of things. So
yeah, I was going to see if I can push it a little bit further. Should we be even excited by the fact that there's always VUCA? That's it's what gives us entrepreneurial opportunity. Can we take that attitude?
I would say yes. I mean, I tell people all the time, I believe I was sent into the world to help people thrive in chaos. So I think that the mindset is the key differentiator of those that will, you know, I really think there's, you could thrive in it, you could merely survive it, or you could be defeated or consumed by it. And I think that if you understand it effectively as a given, and you can operate, then you can operate with it. One of my favorite analogies is surfing. My wife and I were stationed in Hawaii and we took up surfing, and now we have our four kids all surfing, and you never know what you're going to get. You know, the ocean is in a constant state of change, a constant state of flux. And there's things that are somewhat predictable. I mean, we can get information on the tides, or we can know the water temperature, or we could know, you know, what the winds are like, the weather's like. But at the end of the day, the ocean's going to do what the ocean's going to do. It's going to move on its own in its own way. And we have to be able to adapt to that in order to thrive in it. If you've ever seen a surfer on the wave, you know, it's a really good feeling. And it's simply a series of decisions and actions that allowed that individual to thrive in that very relatable example of chaos.
Yeah, it's a great picture. Okay, so we've embraced VUCA. We've got excited about it. We see it as opportunity. There's a next step. I'll just give the verbal description of OODA, OODA, which you'll tell us about. And I'll just note for everybody listening that we'll provide a graphic depiction of the OODA process for visual reference. You can actually find it on Wikipedia if you you look it up there and pretty much anywhere on the internet. But now take us through OODA, Mark.
Sure. OODA is often you hear people say OODA loop. And if you Google OODA loop, you can read articles about it all over the place, not merely military, but you could find it in business journals and things like that. But I elevate, I don't say elevate, but my spin on teaching it is really to emphasize on OODA and showing the loop as the function of OODA. Let me get to that. So it started, OODA comes from a man who passed away in 1997. He's a retired Air Force colonel, and his name was John Boyd. And John Boyd is considered the greatest American strategist. I've heard some, they describe them as the greatest strategist since Sun Tzu. And he was an Air Force officer that originally started his work examining why one pilot would defeat another in a dogfight, you know, in a air-to-air combat. And what he figured out was that the side that could handle the rate of change the fastest would be the one that wins. And as he got further into the theory, he realized that it wasn't just applicable to air-to-air, you know, fighter planes fighting in the sky. It could be applied to war fighting, but then it also could be applied to any form of conflict, including business, where there's opposing sides and competition. The only requirement was human beings that made decisions. So what he eventually came up with after years and years of research, the final iteration of his research right before he died was OODA, or the OODA loop. And it's the way I describe it is it's a diagram of how our orientation works. And orientation is the part that I always really emphasize first. We have to really understand orientation. Orientation is our own internal operating system as individuals. It's how we perceive. It's how we experience the world. It's what's listening to me now. It's what's speaking now. It's how we process that and compute that. In that technology mimics nature, I always say, if you think of orientation as your own internal operating system or your own internal processor of how you calculate what it is that you take in through your senses, which is the first part, observations. I guess I should go back to that. OODA stands for observe, orient, decide, act. The loop is a feedback loop where you would observe, orient, decide, act in a continuous process. You could also change the discussion, as I like to, in both verb and noun, my observations, my orientation, my decisions, my actions. But orientation being the key, orientation is everything. It's our mindset, our education, our previous experience, our emotional state, our ability to process new information, our ability to handle change, our ability to analyze and break things down, and at the same time piece things together and synthesize them into something that didn't currently exist. That is really the key component. So I think when we understand the orientation, then we can start to explain the rest of the pieces and how it functions. So our orientation, if you look at the graphic, it observations are first, and in a feed forward type of scenario, we would bring things in through our senses. Our engagement with our environment, we would process that through our orientation. We would formulate a decision, and then we would test that decision with an action. And then, as it's often described as a loop, when the OODA loop feeds back, we make a new series of observations. If we're doing it right and we're maintaining a dynamic orientation, we've reframed our understanding. We've taken that information, that feedback, and we've broadened or expanded or augmented our orientation to ensure that we're trying to keep it matched to the way things really are. You know, inside the orientation is where we have our all of our biases, all of our cognitive models, all of our mental models. All of that is going to exist inside our orientation. You know, think of our data that we're using to process what we sense and what we see. So is that with me so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of things I picked up as I read some of this and some of your notes, Mark. You say decision is a hypothesis, right?
Yes.
You've got your observed data, you process it through your orientation, then a decision is a hypothesis. It's not, you're not going to be totally positive until you act and see what happens. So just tell us, dwell on decision as a hypothesis.
It's kind of like it's kind of like Mises talking about praxeology and human action, right? We envision a future state, what would happen if we did something, and that's the decision to ultimately act. What we think would happen, what would happen if I'm processing in my orientation that it's cold, I imagine or envision what it would be like warmer, so I might go grab a sweater or turn off the fan. That would be my decision, and then I would act on that. Then I would turn the fan down or put the sweater on. And then as I continue through and I'm continuing the process of UDA, I might decide it's too much. So maybe I'll change the wool sweater for a sweatshirt or something like that, right? I'm constantly learning and getting feedback. But as Mises said, right, we're envisioning what things would be like. We're envisioning a different, I believe he said, we imagine overcoming our uneasiness, in other words, changing our current state and trading it for a different one, ultimately acting, but the action would have to be preceded by a decision, yep. A hypothesis of what we think would happen.
A quick note, did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4BPod. That's Mises.org/E, the number 4, the letter B, POD, and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
But action, as I understand it, is the key. There's the biases for action.
Correct.
Action is a strategy, if you like, or action replaces strategy. Action is for learning, because only if you act can you learn what the next state is. So the bias is about action.
Correct. So we have to have a bias. I like to add learning. We have to have a bias for learning and a bias for action. And they can go in any order. But you think of when we do that test and we see what happens, and when we act, the learning that we see or the new observations that we see will give us a signal which direction that we need to go going forward. What kind of reorientation do we need to do to ensure that our decisions and our actions are aligned with reality?
And then a couple of elements that we like to emphasize and tell us if we're on the right track, Mark. You can't learn strategy from a book. You can't learn it in business school. There's no formulaic prescription. We've arrived at the replacement for strategy. We call it explore and expand, which is constantly doing experiments, which would be the decisions part, acting on those experiments, observing the results, and then you change your orientation if you need to. So we call that explore and expand, which maybe is close to what you're saying, but there's no formula for strategy.
No, I don't think so. And I think what you're hitting on with explore and expand, I think that Boyd would define that as that we're constantly orienting and reorienting. We're constantly building and shaping our perception of the world and changing it to match to reality through exploration and expansion, making sure that processor, as we're scanning our environment, we're making sure that it is aligned to the way the world really is and not what we imagine it to be or hope it to be or want it to be. Instead, we deal with things as it really is. But as you say, the more we explore and the more we expand, we continue to build and shape that orientation and keep it matched. And the more aligned our orientations are with reality, the faster it is that we can process through that loop of continuous observation, orientation, decision, and action. The more that we learn, the more that we build, the faster we could get. That's one of the keys that Boyd would say, is that deliberate action would suggest ultimately we're trying to have speed. You know, we're trying to make decisions with deliberate actions with speed, not haste. Haste is very different than speed. But the faster that you could go through that process, you would be able to maintain effectiveness within the rate of change. You would be able to outpace a competitor, assuming that your ability to process through that was faster. And one thing I would add, as you'll notice on the graph, as you say, explore and expand. So the more that we build that orientation, it's important, because you'll notice that there's two areas on that graph that say implicit guidance and control. And what that means is that our orientation, our perception implicitly guides and controls how we observe. So our perspective as economists, or our perspective as entrepreneurs, our knowledge, our learning, our understanding, it's going to directly affect how we see things. Whereas somebody might see a tragedy, we might see an opportunity. Or as where someone might see an impediment, we might see an opportunity to thrive. And that's all going to depend on the mindset, the orientation that we have. Also, yeah. You'll notice on there too, on the right side of the graphic, that orientation directly or implicitly guides and controls our actions. There's some things that we can just do automatically. You know, there's some things where there are drills or heuristics or procedures that we don't have to stop and think about. We can do them reflexively. And I think what students of John Boyd would say, that the more that, as you say, explore and expand, the more that we build that orientation, the faster we can build that loop, because our orientation implicitly guides and controls how we observe. We can identify something faster than someone that couldn't. So the more matched that orientation is, we could observe and act faster. And that's part of the speedy process that brings speed.
Yep. And then one more point on OODA before we move on, Mark, that I got from your writings, it's really impactful for me, was we're constantly being tested. That's the situation we're in. We're not all in a one-on-one dogfight in an airplane, but we're constantly being tested. Comfort and stasis are not part of the deal. It's constant testing.
I would agree that that's also a very critical part, and that's like Huerta de Soto writes in The Theory of Dynamic Efficiency, that this is a continuous thing, because things are always changing, and that you're always going to be tested. There is no, because time is continuously moving forward. You're always going to be tested and challenged and tried. And that's part of the, I think, the orientation. If we have the proper mindset to that, and we expect that, we expect and we accept and expect it, that's going to speed up our ability to go through OODA faster, because we're going to be more, I think we would be more aligned with reality than someone that wasn't. So there's no, I think we were talking, there's no equilibrium. It's a constant state of movement, just like the ocean. It's in a constant state of flux. Just like that opening line in that chapter in Mises's book, quoting Heraclitus, everything is in a state of ceaseless flux. All is change. All is becoming.
Yeah, there's a great term in complexity theory, which is far from equilibrium. That's the way the world is. It's equilibrium is nowhere to be seen.
I was just going to add, when we think of VUCA, and it's really why Boyd, again, this is from his point of view. But why OODA was effective and why it would always work. And when he wrote his only published paper, and you can find it online, Destruction and Creation, it's the only thing that he ever published other than and it's called the Aerial Attack Study about dogfighting. But the only thing he ever published on this was called Destruction and Creation. I believe it's about eight or nine pages. And he came up with three scientific realities of why he thought that we had to have a framework like OODA. The first is uncertainty, you know, and that's the second part of VUCA. But he was really into studying Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. As a historian economist, the way I understand it is saying that we can't determine both the speed and location of a particle in our body because things are in a constant state of flux. Therefore, precision in determining one would increase the uncertainty in the other. So there is no certainty. That was number one. The second one was Gödel's incompleteness theorem, that it was impossible to have complete, perfect information. It doesn't exist. And then you couldn't prove the efficacy or effectiveness of a system within that system, that there was no way to have all of the information that you would need to be able to do that. And then the last one is my favorite, and that was the second law of thermodynamics, was that we OODA and we refine our orientation and keep it dynamic in order to account for entropy. And entropy is basically, as I understand it, within a closed system, disorder or entropy will continue to increase to the point where we wouldn't be able to undertake a free and independent action. So that's the why he believed it would work. And then I guess without being able to go into the scientific details, this was sort of the quote that I would give for that, you know, given that VUCA is constant and that we can never have perfect information to formulate our decisions and actions, we must maintain an open and flexible or agile approach or orientation in order to avoid imminent defeat brought on by a closed mindset and its resulting entropy. So as you say, expand and explore, we have to continue to expand and explore to build that orientation to account for that, because those are also universal constants. And, you know, those are three things that he brought up, I think, that can just easily be summed up with the word VUCA, or, you know, the term VUCA. So,
well, happily, as individuals and firms and teams, we do have a guide, and that's the third element. You give it the initials IOT, which just literally spells in order to, but it's about...
Yes.
Being proactive, it's about creating, it's about having a mission, it's about value generation as we talk about it. So tell us about IOT.
IOT is stands for not Internet of Things, it stands for in order to, and it was how we would abbreviate inside of a military operations order. I guess it's the military way of saying because. And when we understand the purpose of why something has to happen, we're more likely to achieve that. We're more likely to create. I think we're more effective in creating and coordinating action of all involved to achieve the goal. People are always shocked. I learned this firsthand in the Marine Corps. You know, they don't really tell you how to do things. You know, the book is very small on the things that you can't do. And other than that, you could do whatever so long as the mission was completed. And you had a very wide variety of things that you could do, and you could, you're always empowered. Decision making was always empowered to the lowest level, where that in order to, or that why, or that purpose was understood. So what that did was it ensured that everybody's actions were aligned with what had to be done, or what needed to be done, what the team had to accomplish. And I think it saves a lot of time because it keeps everybody focused on what has to happen. You can eliminate a lot of useless action or, you know, time wasting when everybody understands the purpose of what has to happen. And it has to be simple enough, I think, that everybody can understand it. I think that when I think of it, you know, an effective team or an effective business, I think that everybody is very clear on what needs to be done and really why.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to misquote Mises, but I believe he said all action is purposeful. And I think that focusing on purpose, you know, on intent, on things that have to happen, I think that that's really what drives our actions that flow from our ability to OODA. The actions that come out of that can't be actions for action's sake. They have to be aligned with some kind of a vision, a mission, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it's shared purpose. If you're on a team or in you're in a firm, everybody's got to share in understanding that purpose. And if they're at crossways on that, that becomes another piece of VUCA.
It's like a harmonized symphony. You know, everybody has a role to play, but the ultimate goal is that hopefully in December we'll walk out and we will have heard the Nutcracker, you know, with our kids. Yeah. But everybody has to come together and harmonize to achieve that. Everybody literally in that case has to be on the same sheet of music. But when organizations and teams are on the same sheet of music and everybody understands the ultimate goal of what has to happen, what the final end state desired is, I think that their actions become more effective.
Yeah. And I've learned also there's a even higher step in IoT, Mark. In complexity theory, they talk about emergence, which you've touched on. You don't really know what's going to happen. Results emerge. But in entrepreneurship, at least, if you have shared intent and shared aspiration, you can, in fact, change the probabilities of that outcome. You can't determine them. It's not deterministic, but you can shape them and improve your probabilities. Is that consistent with your thinking?
I would say yes. I would think that if you could achieve the same results by eliminating steps or finding a better way to do something, as long as the final result desired is achieved, then that's ultimately how we would measure, mission accomplishment.
Yeah.
Or success. I could think of countless examples where I was told what needed to be done, but we were able to do it any way we wanted. You know, we had the free, because we all understood what had to happen. You know, you really never have to tell anybody how to do something if they understand what has to be accomplished, because they can align their actions. They can orient to that, right? So that's a critical component of your orientation, is your mission, your values, your vision. And then as you observe, decide, and act, and you continue to loop through that process, you know, you're ensuring, if you're oriented to it effectively, you're ensuring that those actions are all going to be aligned with the stated intent or the stated purpose. And everybody hopefully would understand that. That's really kind of why I try to distill this into three steps rather than countless volumes, because, it's very, I want somebody to understand the why. You know, VUCA is the why. OODA is really the how. And then the what comes with the in order to, with the action in order to. So the why, how, and the what.
But there's another element in your writing, Mark, that is really important to us at Economics for Business and in economics general, and that's relationships. So that's a piece of shared purpose, the importance of relationships. In fact, you distill it another piece, which is it's people, ideas, and things in that order. It starts with people. So just talk about relationships and people here.
If there's one thing that John Boyd left us that we would want to remember other than OODA, it would be that. People, ideas, and things, always in that order. All action is human action. All decisions are human decisions. All teams are made out of humans. They're organic organizations of thinking people that, if they're on a team together, they interrelate and they have some alignment. Everybody's orientation is unique, but at some point orientation aligns such that we could coordinate action together and harmonize our efforts. So relationships are crucial with colleagues, with teammates, customers, vendors, strategic partners, superiors, subordinates, peers. Relationships are crucial because Boyd said people first. Oftentimes you buy a thing and you try to retrofit it and doesn't really work that way. Or you think of a great idea to execute, but it doesn't take into account the people that you have. The people always are first, because that's who decides and that's who acts. You know, it's the people first. Those are the people that make up the firm, the team, the organization.
Yeah.
It's people. And so that's something that he hammered over and over and over again. And a lot of the people that I know, that we could, you know, I could point as sources for a better command of what Boyd would say, would certainly echo that point, that people, ideas, things, always in that order.
Yeah, and I always think of that on the customer side, whether that's a business-to-business customer or a consumer, that we're dealing with people, value is subjective, their preferences are not necessarily explicable objectively, they change. Dealing with people is the essence of being an entrepreneur, and those people are your customers.
Serving people, and you know, so that everybody is back to the all involved. Everybody's better off for having worked together.
Well, Mark, we've romped through an awful lot of material in a relatively short period of time, but let's try and sum up. Again, I'll emphasize for everybody listening, we'll publish the OODA graphic, and we have a summary of Mark's writing that we'll be able to share. But sum up for us. The notes that I made, Mark, is the world is always VUCA. Therefore, we must always use OODA as our tool to thrive in VUCA through adaptation. And we must focus on our mission, our IoT, because action is purposeful, goal-oriented, mission-driven. So that's my summary, and I'm sure you can do better.
I think that's a very fair restatement. I would agree. And I would emphasize that, again, the goal that I had in shaping and refining this approach was always to make sure that theory is addressed, and that there's no recipe, there's no formula, that if we understand these principles, regardless of what our business is, regardless of what industry we're in, I think my thought is that the more that we understand these concepts and ideas, the way becomes evident. The way becomes evident, and individuals and teams are able to come up with their own solution. So there's no recipe. The theory really has to be understood, but hopefully that distillation down to 3 points. I've shown this to several people in my my past career that have since retired and gone to other things, and they said, "Wow, you distilled all of our coursework into just 3 simple ideas." And that's really the goal, is just that you could take it, you could think about it, and then you could try to apply it, and then from that point on, when somebody does embrace it, then you can get in depth as it relates to whatever it is they're doing. But you'd find that the concepts are going to apply everywhere. The only requirement is humans that make decisions and actions.
Yeah.
Which is everywhere.
Good. Well, I just thought of one last question. Maybe we can leave with this. When you teach this and when people do embrace it, Mark, are you able to leave them with confidence that I can deal with VUCA and generate a good OODA loop, or do they leave with a heightened understanding, but not necessarily more confidence?
Okay, that's a great question. I would say case by case, but I'd say there's probably a Pareto, 80% get it, maybe 20% don't. Or maybe sometimes I've said, if I told this to 100 people, 20 would come up afterwards and ask for more information, how they could apply it. And of those 20, 20% of them would actually really embrace it or implement it. But I think that those that I've seen integrate this across a myriad of disciplines and industries, once they understand the basics, and once it starts to become evident, starts to become apparent when you know what to look for, you tend to find it. You know, if you understand something, you tend to see it when you encounter it. I've had a lot of people say, "Oh, this doesn't apply to me," I was never in the military, and I said, "Well, if you like, I could bring my 12-year-old daughter in, because she can breathe this and she can tell you how it works in volleyball, and how she talks about OODA with her volleyball team, and how you know, the mindset, you know, and how they coordinate action together, how they observe things. I mean, she can literally get up and get all four of my children could get up and give the entire brief. And I tried to really make it so it was simple enough that anybody could understand it. Cause again, I believe that this applies to everybody, just like the concept of praxeology, you know, human action applies to everybody. So my end goal is that the better we understand these concepts, the more effective that we can become in whatever it is that we're doing. As Boyd said, a sound understanding and application of these concepts will yield geometric results. So
good. Okay, perfect. Well, Mark, thanks for sharing. Our aim is to build a community of confident entrepreneurs using our principles, and you've certainly added to them. So we appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thanks, Hunter.
Economics for Business is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. And for more from Hunter Hastings, visit HunterHastings.com.